thinking of going back to Wittgenstein and the link with postmodernism. So I can see the link, but I see it, I see Wittgenstein a little bit differently. I feel like he's in a way moved on from that. He's not. He's not. I'm probably completely wrong here, but coming at it like from looking at Foucault, it almost like does seem like anarchy in a way, you know, not so much Nietzsche, but that kind of thing where we're just going to look at this thing that we have and we're just going to smash it up. But for Wittgenstein, he's more about sorting out problems. You know, it's like he's more about he sees something that's annoying him, like, you know, like that engineering mind, and he wants to fix it. And you know, his way of coming up with, you know, language games and all that, even though we're moving away from essences, it was the only way forward for him, the only way that made sense, rather than dismantling a system.
Yes,
that was the only thing.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, in some ways, postmodernism is if you were looking at it from a Wittgensteinian point of view, and postmodernism's moment is at the moment of the ladder. I think postmodernism is basically Wittgenstein's ladder.
Yeah.
They're, you know, all well and good. We need to kick this. You know, so postmodernism comes along. We need to kick away the grand narratives, because you know they lead us down a particular set of a particular path that has been colonized and has been kind of and has been performed by vested interests and whatever over so many years, and we're in that kind of rut that we're only allowed to see the world. I mean, it's kind of Orwell's doublespeak. You know, you can only say what the state has allowed you to be able to say, because it's constrained the use of language.
Yeah.
So postmodernism says, you know, open your eyes in a way, kick these things aside, kick the ladders away, and then they bugger off.
Yeah.
Because, you know, after that, it's kind of, yeah, okay, right, you know, you're all lying on the floor staring at the stars now. Mm. You're, you know, rubbing your head going, God, you know, I fell off that ladder. you know, I've not seen, you know, my gutters are damaged and, you know, there's rain coming through the roof and I've not seen this before and, I've never kind of been in this position before. And then the postmoderns just leave you to do that. Mm. And in a way, that's... In a sense, that's their job. I think once they start to come up with anything more substantial, it's like obviously not exactly, but it's like with Sartre. Mm. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre has this whole, you know, the kind of the famous French existentialist, early 20th century, and it's all about, and it's all about making choices. You make your choices, and as long as the choices are authentic, it doesn't matter what choice you make. Mm. For authentic existence, the main thing is not to be led by the herd. Again, not to be led by the grand narrative. Mm. Again, getting back to Nietzsche as well, don't be led by the herd. You make your choices. Mm. You know, you can do this or you can not do that, and it doesn't really matter which of these things you do, as long as you do that from a point of view of your own kind of self-authoring. Mm. But even Sartre gets to a point where he realizes that it's very difficult to make ethical judgments or, you know, from within that. Because if you're saying, well, you just have to make a choice, so you can say, well, yeah, I choose to be a mass murderer. Mm. You know, I choose to oppress the poor. At one level, you know, the existentialist would have to say, well, if that's an authentic decision, and you're not just oppressing the poor and being a mass murderer because your parents were, then, you know, crack on. Now, of course, Sartre doesn't want to say this, so inevitably he ends up becoming increasingly more Marxist.
Yeah,
because Marxism gives him the narrative.
He's trying to reconcile to be able to judge. Wasn't he? He was trying to reconcile the kind of. The social structure working together, but also the individual. He was trying to do that,
yes.
Wasn't he? It seems like to me, the postmodernism stuff can really, really lead you to kind of an extreme form of liberalism. You know.
Well, it could do, yeah, yeah. I mean, kind of, you know, it could be construed as a form of libertarianism if you're not careful, and I'm sure that wasn't the intention, but it's I mean, I have great sympathies with the postmoderns. I quite like the idea of there being local narratives. And I think that's, I think the idea that you know, we have, that we can ever have as a human species, ever have a God's eye view as of the universe, you know, and ourselves, and is a, it's a fiction of the Enlightenment. It's a part of the myth of religion, that, you know, you can either be God, or you could, you know, as the Enlightenment suggests, or you can have access to the gods who are looking down. Do you ever see that? Oh, that there's a. Do you ever see the? You must have seen the Jason and the Argonauts movie.
Oh yes, I love that. Yeah.
Ray Harryhausen, brilliant movie. Anybody's not seen that, where have you been? but they do that in this really, I mean, in this kind of quaint sort of way, that you've got kind of Jason and you've got the various kind of characters and the mythological creatures and all doing their thing, and then it kind of pans back beyond the clouds, and you've got the gods. Honor Blackman, for example, is Athena. God bless her, because she passed away recently. And sat there, kind of around a chess table, and they're just like kind of looking down onto the earth, and they can see the entire scope. They see the whole kind of, you know, the entire terrain of human existence, and they're kind of moving things around, and you've got the kind of chess, the conceit of the chessboard. And so, you know, from a religious point of view, that was always a thing. You know, we can always kind of, even though we don't see it ourselves, we have access to God or the gods, and they can see the entire, that they can see the entire thing, and we fit into that kind of map. And then the Enlightenment comes along and says, no, we don't need that anymore. But we still, as Nietzsche points out, we still have that kind of grand narrative, because we still have kind of reason cashed out in terms of kind of the scientific method. As a way of standing back from the universe, and being able to kind of make grand judgments about it. And I think, you know, postmodernism comes in and says, well, you know, we can't do that. We are never in a God's eye position. Even if one wanted to be sympathetic towards a religious perspective, there's no reason why you shouldn't be. You know, we are not God. We don't have access to the mind of God. So, you know, we have no, you know, you do get a lot of people from a religious perspective kind of almost acting as if they speak with the voice of God, and that they can see what God sees. Well, that's never what any religion, as I'm aware of, would want to say. You know, religion is all to do with kind of interpreting the kind of the religious text, interpreting the visions and the dreams and so on. We could get it wrong. You know, we are not God. And if you get into that Enlightenment moment, you know, where do we stand to make supreme judgments about the nature of the universe? Well, we don't. And this is where people like Foucault would say, you know, has this suspicion bordering on disdain for the social sciences, because he says, you know, man, by which he means human beings cannot look themselves in the face. You know, we are not a legitimate study for ourselves, because we have a vested interest.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we can never say anything. We can never make rational and objective judgments about our children, because our children are always the best children in the world. And would never do anything wrong, and would never spit at little Johnny in the playground, because that's not what our kids do. You know, and human beings are not appropriate to the study of themselves. So everything we say about ourselves is always going to be coloured by, you know, where we stand and our attitudes to, you know, each other and ourselves and so on. Sorry, I got a bit carried away there. But those are the things I quite like about postmodernism. It dethrones us.
Yeah.
Stops us being a bit too cocky. You know?
Yeah. I know what you mean. But I always think that, well, where does it leave you? Where does it leave us?
Ah, well. Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, where it leaves you, it doesn't leave you with the system intact. I think it takes you kind of back. And a lot of this is that there are echoes of the phenomenologist that we've already been talking about. The idea of kind of looking at the world in which we live, being part of the world in which we live, not trying to kind of create stereotypes or systems or generalized statements or, you know, labels that somehow force the experience of the world into our interpretative schema. You know, and I think that's where postmodernism does its job. It's saying, well, look at the world. You know, not all blonde women are stupid. You know, I mean, that old kind of stereotypical gag, you know, the blonde, the, sorry, everybody, if you're not familiar with that, but certainly in the UK, you know, there was a tradition of the dumb blonde. I think it happens in the States as well. I've met a lot of blonde women in my time. And to my knowledge, none of them were particularly stupid. But once you start creating that narrative, you start collapsing into kind of stereotypes. You start collapsing into labeling people, and you start altering the facts of existence to fit your interpretative schema, your kind of your framework, your grand narrative. That's where you belong in the story.
Yeah,
and I think that's where it's at its strongest.
I think it's important to understand where this comes in a certain point of a story. What are you trying to build here? If you're trying to build something like a civilization, or trying to build a moral outlook, or you know, you can't really get anywhere if you're constantly being critical, you know. And everyone's got something to say about it, and so that's what worries me about it. So on the one hand, it's always good to be, you know, to be asking questions. You know, it's like that famous graffiti I saw once. It was a big anarchy sign, and someone wrote "Anarchy, question everything," and then below it, someone's written small letters "Why."
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's the kind of that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, and one of the main critiques of postmodernism have taken that kind of relativizers position, that, you know, if these people are saying that everything is that you know, we have a relative perspective on the world, and that, you know, our points of view are dependent on where we stand, and then we shouldn't be kind of wedded to a particular meta narrative or story or structure or whatever, then you're saying that presumably from the point of view of somebody who's standing on a particular position and have a particular understanding about, you know, the nature of human beings and what should be right and what should be wrong and how we should comport ourselves. So you have to stand somewhere to make any kind of judgment, no matter how small the you know, the land you're standing on. Sooner or later you are making some kind of stand.
Yeah, because
you're
living in society now, and it's real and it's happening. So I remember having an argument with a lecturer at university. It wasn't you.
No, you're always very polite to me.
Yeah, it wasn't really an argument, but it was starting to get on my nerves because it was about postmodernism. And back then, I was a bit more of a kind of, I'd say, more of a Marxist, more of a kind of, you know, I didn't like hearing about postmodernism because it was interfering with my outlook. But she did say something I thought was a bit silly. And one of the things I brought up was, so talking about the there's no fundamental essence for everything. There's no meaning for anything. You know, it's always can be undercut. And I was saying that, you know, there are. It's a fact now, out in the world, there are people who are suffering and they're starving, and you know, that they need to eat. And then her, what she said to that was, well, maybe one day we won't need to eat. People won't need to eat.
Solid.
Yeah, an argument. Yes.
Yeah.
You know.
That sounds like a tutor just trying to fob off a really irritating student.
Yeah. It's probably being just as annoying as that. You know, that answer was. But that was kind of struck at home. I've carried that a long way because I was thinking, you know, it is good. You can't just argue about anything. You know, it's like this lockdown thing. We have people even in this country heard about in the US demonstrating about to be allowed to be let out. And on the one hand, it's like, you know, people need to earn money. They're not working. So you can kind of understand that. But on the other hand, it's like, oh, it's to do with our freedom. We can do what we like, you know, and that kind of continual attack, criticism on on things, then you have to you've got no recourse but to go to back to science and reason. You have to. Yeah, and we know that obviously the postmoderns, especially Foucault, attacked those institutions, didn't they? Those science, health and psychiatry. And yes. So where does it, again, where does it leave us? If we can't, what can we rest something on? We do, we live in society right now. We have society, and we have to put those, we have to build something on that, rather than say, well, maybe one day we won't need to eat.
That's brilliant. I'd love to know. I have to chat to you later to find out if I can identify who said that to you. I see where you're coming from there, and I think that's the potential problem with any relativistic approach. Partly, it depends on more formal grand narratives to frame the issues. It's very similar to people who are complaining about situations and yet they are dependent on the political situation. So it's kind of people kind of making comments about it's the awful capitalism we're involved in, but at the same time they're enjoying the benefits of it. People who are. I mean, I always remember kind of having arguments with media types who were saying, "Oh, well, it's all to do with media is to do with the kind of the deconstruction of the form. It's not to do with the content." And so, but you can only do that because you've had content to discuss. So it's almost, I don't want to get on my high horse about, the validity of media studies. I mean, there's some very interesting stuff done there. But it might, if everybody kind of did media studies, there will be nobody producing output. There'll be nobody producing stories, and there'll be nobody producing films, and there'll be nobody producing music and so on. These things demand and require content to be able to comment on. And I think the thing with postmodernism is, if you're not careful, you have no content. You have nothing other than just a lot of angry young men running around saying, you can't do this, you can't do that, this is wrong, you're not seeing it in the right way. Okay, well, if we're not seeing it in the right way, what is the right way exactly? I can't tell you that, because there is no right way. So how do you know that's crap? How do you know that's bad? It's like, how do you know it's a bad film or a bad piece of music or a bad story, unless you've got some kind of... So that sense of the need of an absolute is particularly in ethics, it's a serious issue. And of course, postmodernism tries to shy away from the need to fill that gap. But I mean, eventually it will get filled, because you have to.
Is there a paradox there, though? Is it like, if there's no...
Yeah, definitely.
So, to have the idea that there's no essence, then you must have the idea of an essence.
I think so. Mm. I quite like Heidegger's understanding. I've used this a number of times throughout our podcast, but I do like Heidegger's idea of things being under erasure, that in the sense that everything is written in pencil. Such that you sit light to it, and you can kind of rub it out and adjust as things develop. And I think one of the beauties of the human condition, and we sell ourselves short because we don't really appreciate this often enough, is our ability to hold things in tension. Things don't necessarily have to fit like a jigsaw puzzle. We don't have to adopt a model where everything has to be unproblematic. We can walk a knife edge. Things can overlay in a messy sort of way. It doesn't have to be tidy. And I think we go right back to kind of Descartes' idea of clear and certain knowledge, which I think has been a bane to Western epistemology and Western thinking. Things don't need to be clear and certain. You know, we've said this before, and again, this is very much in stuff we find in Wittgenstein, oddly enough. Mm. So the idea that, you know, there are, you know, if I want to say, and if I say, for example, you know, that I love my daughter, for example, mm. I'm not entirely sure what I'm saying.
Mm. Mm.
I couldn't, anything I would possibly say to help to define that comes under attack by postmoderns by saying, well, you know, what does that even mean? You know, that's you're limiting it. You're trying to kind of have a grand narrative. You're standing back and saying, "Ah, yes, what we're talking about here is romantic love, or what we're talking about here is the notion of love drawn from religion or from great plays and great literature." What do you mean by that? And I'm not entirely sure, rationally, what I mean by that. I mean, it is significant to me and it is meaningful to me, but I'm not entirely sure I can.
Yeah,
I can rationalise it.
Yeah, and you're sure that it's meaningful to you, and you're sure.
Yes, but I'm not sure why. But I'm not sure why or how, and I couldn't articulate this. And it changes depending on our. You know, it changes over time. Doesn't get less, greater or lesser significantly, but it changes over time, and it can be held in tension. And so, for example, I can be really angry and frustrated at my daughter.
Mm.
I'm not sorry, it's fine, I'm not, but I could be. Mm. That doesn't negate the fact that I love my daughter.
Mm.
So I can hold those two things in tension, is that they're not mutually exclusive.
Mm.
So I think, you know, I think the idea of being able to say, yes, you know, we can commit ourselves to a particular perspective, which allows us the ability to make socio-ethical comments and to stand for particular things.
Mm.
But we do that under erasure, that we get into a situation, we get into a circumstance where we need to be prepared to say, actually, I'm not God, I didn't see this coming. Mm. Or actually, I need to change my mind on this. Mm-hmm. You know, I think postmodernism, when it's functioning effectively, encourages us to say there's nothing wrong with altering your perspective. That's not a failure or weakness on your part.
There was a quote, isn't there, but from Foucault on this. I'll see if I can find it quickly. Hang on. Do not ask me who I am, and do not ask me to remain the same.
Mm.
And that's the main part when it goes on. Leave it to our bureaucrats and our police to see that our papers are in order.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who said that?
That's Foucault.
Yeah, nails it on the head. Mm. I mean, it nails it on the head. I mean, so Foucault's, you know, what we're saying here is that we are always in transition. As our worlds change, and as we move across the different worlds, our identities change. Mm. And we shouldn't allow, as it's only the kind of the rigidity of a grand narrative that refuses to allow us to morph.
Yeah.
And to change our identity, or to change, you know, the way we see the world. So yeah, I think that's great. And so that map is not territory kind of thing that crops up a lot. Yeah. The idea that, you know, that a map is that kind of grand narrative view. This is how everything is laid down, and it's rock solid in the map.
Mm.
And this is how we. But territory has, you know, you can just wander across territory. It's got flowers, and it's got grass, and it's got dog poo in it. You may have to step around. And, you know, it's got a whole bunch of stuff which doesn't show up on the map.